Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. It's been more than a week since the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. The events, including the death of one protester and the president's reactions, have created a firestorm of debate about free speech, history, and racism. Organizers of the rally in Charlottesville promised more rallies to come, but now are canceling some of them due to backlash. Today, we'll take a look at the recent conflicts over race from an indigenous perspective. We're back right after the news. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people in Arizona are among those planning to protest President Trump's Tuesday visit to the state. According to the White House, Trump is touring U.S. Customs and Border Protection equipment and meeting with military service members. The president will later hold a rally at the Phoenix Convention Center. Some indigenous groups, including Arizona Stands, which advocates for environmental protections, plans to show opposition of the visit with day-long events. Banner making, drumming, prayer, and a march are part of the agenda. Some areas of concern among indigenous people are protecting sacred sites and the environment from development. Native groups in the state have also spoken out against the Trump administration's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Students at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, started out their first day of classes with education about the solar eclipse. They stood outside just 40 miles from the direct path, but clouds covered the show. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
As time counted down to the eclipse, the sky darkened and the cicadas started singing. The only thing missing was seeing the event as clouds obscured the view. Haskell student Shay Crowfeather says the weather was a small letdown.
I'm here because this is a very unique experience, and it's very blessed that we're in an area that we can see it in almost its totality.
Haskell faculty Lucas Miller said the university wanted to respect all tribal traditions of the students and give an educational experience.
We definitely want to be respectful of various tribal traditions that deal with the eclipse, and some tribes are not doing anything during the eclipse. Others have specific practices or traditions. We are encouraging all of our students and our faculty and our staff to practice whatever tradition or that is specific to them.
Students still felt it was a fun way to start the semester. For National Native News, I'm Rhonda Lavaldo.
The Pine Ridge Reservation's Oglala Lakota College has joined South Dakota's School of Mines and Technology and South Dakota State University in a pre-engineering collaborative. Jim Kent reports.
The pre-engineering educational collaborative began 7 years ago with the mainstream universities assisting Oglala Lakota College to build capacity for engineering programs. That means improving the quality of science, technology, engineering, and math courses at OLC and the professional development of the school's faculty and staff. Jennifer Benning is an associate professor at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. She says the parallel goal is getting Native students involved in engineering studies.
It's recognized that for a lot of Native American students, it is more affordable. It's easier to start their programs at tribal colleges, close to home, close to families. And then the idea is that they would take the first few years of their engineering education programs at the tribal college, and then we have articulation agreements, so the credits are accepted and transferred to the mainstream university partners.
Native students would then complete their education at South Dakota State University or the School of Mines. The summer intensive engineering program sees students research issues relevant to their community, from affordable and energy-efficient housing to greenhouse and food production to water management for buffalo. A National Science Foundation grant funds the pre-engineering educational collaborative, but Professor Benning notes that the aim is to develop a plan to institutionalize the program to avoid reliance on the grant process. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. It's been a little over a week since white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, Virginia. The news value of the deadly violence and that engulfed the city might have died down some, if not for President Trump's insistence on criticizing the people protesting against the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and others intent on fulfilling a repugnant agenda.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? Let me ask you this. What about the fact they came charging, that they came charging with clubs in their hands, swinging clubs? Do they have any problem? I think they do. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a horrible, horrible day. Wait a minute. I'm not finished. I'm not finished, fake news. That was a horrible day. I will tell you something. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you have you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
That was the president during a contentious freeform press conference 2 days after a woman was killed, allegedly by a white supremacist who drove his car into a crowd of protesters. Some of the white supremacist rally participants have been arrested. Others have lost their jobs after their racist views were exposed publicly. Still, leaders of radical organizations insist on planning more rallies at cities around the country. Over the weekend, a small group of right-wing protesters organized what they said was a free speech rally in Boston. They insisted the white supremacy message was not the centerpiece of the event. That did not stop 20,000 counter-protesters from showing up and shouting down the rally speakers. Are we at a pivotal moment in which racist violence is gaining momentum, spurred on by ambiguous language from political leaders? Or is this just another wave in the long-standing racism in this country? Do you know what to do to counter racists, whether they're marching with torches in your town or they're in your Facebook feed? And where do Native Americans fit into this discussion? Encountering racists is nothing new in Native America, particularly in border towns. Today's your day to sound off on this issue. Phone lines are open for you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I'd like to introduce my panel now. Joining us now is Dr. James Ridingen. He is the Interim Director of American Indian Studies at Arizona State University. He's also the editor of Wichaso Shah, the Journal of Native American Studies, and he is Pawnee. Welcome back, James.
Thank you.
Also joining us from New York City is Julian Brave Noisecat. He is a writer and a regular contributor to The Guardian, and he is Shuswap. Welcome, Julian.
Thanks so much for having me, Monica.
Absolutely. And joining us also on the line is Jenny Monet. She is a freelance journalist, and she is Laguna Pueblo. Hey there, Jenny.
Hi. Great to be back, Monica. Thanks.
All right. So much to cover, so much to talk about. James, I'd like to start with you. Any thoughts on the president's comments about both sides were at fault?
Yeah, this whole incident that happened in Virginia is very troubling. And when I heard him say that both sides are at fault, I reflect back in history. And I remember some of the books I read as I was a graduate student studying history about westward expansion. And historians often said that both sides were to blame, that Indians and whites were to blame for the conflict that that erupted with settlers moving across the hemisphere. Well, that's like saying that if someone enters your home and you resist, you're equally to blame. So this equal blame notion is a part of history. It's deeply rooted in history, and unfortunately, it continues to be. And it was expressed by a president of the United States who has no understanding, it seems like, of racial relations. He is one who incites these types of outbursts that we saw in Virginia. And he also encourages these racists to speak out and to organize and to try to get their racist agenda popularized once more.
I mean, how does he encourage them to do that? We haven't, I mean, when this first happened, he definitely said that he condemns the KKK and condemns white supremacist groups. So, you know, how is he doing that?
He does it by turning back on the words that he says and saying something different that that caters to his political base. And not everyone who is a part of his political base share these racial attitudes, but a significant number does. So I think he's sending probably subtle messages to them saying that it's okay. We're not going to come down on you with law enforcement if you go on beyond what's acceptable behavior in terms of the law.
Jenny, what do you think?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about where the position's loyalty lies in his doublespeak. The fact that he came out with his first statements, you know, describing both sides and then retracting that and then coming back again and, you know, basically reinforcing some level of what seemed like support to white supremacists on his very statements. I mean, you had David Duke, you know, the Klan leader, coming forward and thanking the president for his statements that almost gave sheer agency to their placement and their actions in Charlottesville. The fact that a woman died in all of this and that there was not even a phone call to the mother or the family until it was maybe an afterthought and they were in the midst of their funeral just speaks volumes. In the past of any kind of presidential history, we saw condolences and just heavy hearts in situations like this, and it took a nation to rise up on its own to show those merits of how we are carrying that humanity in the absence of this presidency right now.
We're talking about the events in Charlottesville and how it connects to Native America. If you want to weigh in on that conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got James writing in with us, Julian Brave Noise Cat, and Jenny Monet. And Julian, you wrote a piece for the CBC Indigenous titled Racism and Hate in Charlottesville Are Homegrown. You said, confronting mass bigotry, the immediate instinct of the body politic was to repress and then expunge the heretics as categorically foreign and historically degenerate, the unwanted offspring of a freak campaign and election season gone awry. Are you challenging that idea that this is just an anomaly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when Paul Krugman goes to the column in the New York Times and he says that Trump is un-American and all these politicians from, you know, House Speaker Paul Ryan to the former Bushes, you know, take to their Twitter feeds or their press boxes and they, you know, say their deal about how racism and bigotry are evil and are, you know, not the values supported by their country. I think that they're, you know, they're lying to the public about the reality of the history of this country. They're spinning a myth that, you know, as many of your listeners are probably well aware, is not the truth of indigenous people or people of color in this nation. And yeah, you know, quite frankly, I thought that it was remarkable how surprised people were that the president was, you know, so warm to white nationalists. We have to remember that this is a man who you know, I'm in New York today. He called for the execution of the Central Park Five, you know, a group of young African American men wrongly accused of raping a jogger. It actually turned out that they hadn't done it. And he called for the, you know, for them to be fully prosecuted under the law. He went to Warsaw and he spoke the dog whistle politics of, you know, Western civilization under attack. And we all know what the real suggestion is there. And, you know, just a week before Charlottesville, went and spoke to a group of police and suggested that they should brutalize the people who they are arresting, et cetera. And we all know who those people are racialized as. So I think that, you know, this is a president who has been, you know, speaking the doublespeak, as Jenny sort of put it, of racism, using dog whistle politics left and right. And I think that we need to look at ourselves in the mirror as a nation, right? These are not values that are foreign to America. They are actually values that are espoused at the highest levels of our government. I think that when we confront that reality and that terrible truth, you know, we are telling the truth about the nation, that we can actually maybe do something about it.
So are you saying that we shouldn't be shocked? But I'm just curious, if we're not shocked at his behavior, then does a complacency come along with not being shocked?
No, I mean, I don't think that, you know, the people who were involved in the civil rights movement, I don't think that they were complacent. I don't think that, you know, our ancestors who were involved in the Red Power movement, the movement for Native self-determination, I do not think that they were complacent. I think that my essential point is that there is great continuity in the that racism, as I wrote in the piece, is not exception in these United States, but that it is status quo. And that we need to start confronting it as such, right? When Paul Krugman takes to the New York Times press and says, you know, this is un-American, I don't think he's studied American history closely enough, because, you know, there were, for example, there were more African Americans who were lynched in the South in the years after World War I than actually died in battle, right? Like, racism in the United States is deeply entrenched and lethal.
Well, we saw a significant counter protest in Boston, though, this past weekend, and white supremacist organizers are canceling rallies. So are we seeing a turning point in this situation, Julian?
I mean, so I think that to say that racism is deeply entrenched is also not to suggest that there aren't other values that exist and that can be leached, you know, latched onto, and that there aren't people out there who think that racism is wrong. I mean, don't get me wrong. I grew up in Oakland, California. I went to, you know, Berkeley High School. There's, you know, certainly, you know, dozens of the kids who I grew up with and, you know, the people who educated me, et cetera, are the kind of people who are definitely out there protesting the white supremacists, confronting the white supremacists. And I think that that is absolutely essential. But that's not to say that, you know, in certain areas of this country, in certain political circles, these views, you know, about other people, about people of different races, et cetera, are you know, still completely in circulation behind closed doors or even on the University of Virginia campus.
We are talking about racism today, what happened in Charlottesville, and what is the Native perspective on this? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Another part of this discussion has to do with statues. The protesters in Charlottesville, the white supremacist groups, were protesting the removal, the potential removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. Here's more from President Trump at the press conference on August 15th. He insisted the Charlottesville rally participants were not all white supremacists, but were people who merely wanted to peacefully protest the planned removal of the Robert E. Lee statue.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Those people were also there because they wanted to protest the taking down of a statue, Robert E. Lee. So, excuse me, and you take a look at some of the groups and you see, and you know it if you were honest reporters, which in many cases you're not, but many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. So, this week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Since Charlottesville, several cities have taken down monuments of Confederate symbols. Is this a new trend towards recognizing the hurt that some of these monuments represent? What do you think about it? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. James, you know, is this really just about statues and whether or not to take them down or keep them up?
Yeah, it's a much broader issue. And for American Indians, part of the problem is the discussion of race in this country focuses on black and white concerns. And when we heard Trump's dim-witted attempts to place Robert E. Lee on the same moral plane as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, we saw a reaction by political analysts, pundits, and others who were shocked that he would do that. But as was said by one of our other panelists, you know, this attitude is deeply rooted in this country's history. And what's missing from this discussion is, well, what did George Washington and Thomas Jefferson do or have to say about American Indians? And was their actions racist? You know, these pundits, they present Lee as being a traitor and Washington and Jefferson as being, although flawed, as heroic nation builders. But this is a half-baked comparison when we look at history, because Washington used the savage as a wolf metaphor to justify the development of policies that were anti-Indian, that called for using treaties to take Indian lands. Well, you know, I think that Helm and these other people at that time realized that these treaties would be short-term solutions to acquire more and more Indian land. And during the Revolutionary War, Washington commanded his troops to conduct a scorched earth campaign against the Iroquois. So he's not without his biases. He didn't enforce treaties that could have been done to protect Indian lands, but pretty much allowed for the encroachment into Indian lands to ensue, and then to call in federal troops when Indians resisted. And then there's good old Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, who was the author of the Declaration of Independence. And these are his words that he used in defaming Indians. He says, "The English king," and I'm quoting now, "has excited domestic insurrections against us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." Well, you know, again, who was the aggressor in this? And to cast people as savages for protecting their homelands, their cultures, and their futures is a part of American history that we're still dealing with today, you know, through historical trauma, through our struggles for treaty rights, for our sovereignty, for our cultural survival. And we do have our brave warriors out there who are resisting, both men and women. The Standing Rock opposition to DAPL is one. You know, American Indian movement has a long history of a resistance, and that's still going on. And even those who don't necessarily support those beliefs and philosophies have been protesting as well. So, and on the other side, it's good to see the non-Indians siding with this fight against the white supremacists. When I was watching footage of the incident at Charlottesville, mostly what I saw was non-Indians fighting non-Indians or whites fighting whites. So to me, there's promise that we can endure. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of these attitudes that promotes such discontent in this country, but we cannot turn our backs on this history or the present circumstances stemming from that past.
Julian, you also have written about these statues and confronting them and bringing them down. Is the general idea that they need to come down, or that we just need to know the true history of these people that we've revered and put in statues?
Well, so I wouldn't juxtapose those two things, right? I think that so people, I think, often perceive taking down a statue as, in some sense, an attack on history, as though we are Maoists who want to, like, delete the all history of prior injustice so that we can create a new a society anew, which is absolutely not, not the point. It's not the point is not to, like, deface statues to delete that history. The point is actually to put that history into its proper context and its proper set of understanding, which is not as, a celebrated cast of heroes who, espouse these values of liberty and individualism and equality, and, you know, maybe have these distasteful views about race and slavery and, the conquest of our ancestors. I think that we need to consider taking many of these statues down, not just of Confederates, but also of people who perpetuated Western conquest, who perpetuated in many instances genocide against indigenous people, and that is not an attack on history, but a move to put history in its proper context, right? Maybe, a museum is a more appropriate place to see with regard our Confederate past. Maybe a museum is a more appropriate place to, behold a statue of Junipero Serra, who was the architect of California's, mission system that ended up in the deaths of thousands and thousands of California indigenous peoples. So that is the central point. And I think while there's this moment of attention to Confederate monuments and the legacy of racism that they have perpetuated, that we need to also advance the point about monuments to Columbus, monuments to Custer, monuments to Junipero Serra, monuments to countless other, figures from our past who perpetuated injustice against the First Peoples of these lands.
I saw that the statue of Junipero, one of them was, they painted blood on his hands recently, and I thought that was an interesting take or way to sort of counter instead of taking the statue down. We're not just talking about statues today. We're also talking about racism, and it's what happened in Charlottesville. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. The Navajo Nation recently passed a new law criminalizing sex trafficking on the reservation. It's the latest attempt to fight what tribal officials say is the growing threat of people who prey on naive or desperate young girls. On the next Native America Calling, we'll look at the efforts to address sex trafficking in Indian Country. Please join us.
Hey, yam is to medical cause all the not do. Look here, all of a yam out of that to medicate that to cheap and out of that not do. 1-800-318-2596 and Ben and Argon. That is medicate.gov. Look here, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services don't know what Ben and Ito look in our way. Ella, qua.
Support by AARP. At AARP, we create and connect you to unique tools and programs, help you save money, and tackle the issues that matter most to you, your family, and your community. What we do might surprise you, like sponsoring the Native American Journalist Association National Conference in Anaheim, California, September 7th through the 9th. Information at aarp.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. We're talking about racism today, the recent events in Charlottesville, the fight over Confederate statues, and President Trump's response. What do you think? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Satire is one of the more creative responses to political conflict. Saturday Night Live presented a special edition of their weekend update news segment. Comedian Tina Fey proposed that instead of going to rallies and tangling with neo-Nazis, you should instead just eat a whole sheet cake. And she brought up Standing Rock into the discussion.
And then next time when you see a bunch of white boys in polo shirts scream about taking our country back, and you want to scream, it's not our country, we stole it from the Native Americans. We stole it from the Native Americans. And when they have a peaceful protest at Standing Rock, we shoot at them with rubber bullets. But we let you chinless turds march through the streets with semi-automatic weapons.
Did comparisons with Standing Rock occur when you watched Charlottesville unfold? Phone lines are open for you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Sunny in Ulrich, South Dakota, tuned in on Keeley. Hey there, Sunny.
Hello. How are you, Monica?
Good, good. What do you think? What do you want to weigh in on?
Well, I've been listening to your discussion on racism and Charlottesville and all of these things that unfortunately rear their ugly head every now and then. It's all cyclical, I think. It happens, I don't know how often, but it goes on and on and on. We fight it constantly throughout the nations, myself in Hollywood, specifically when it comes to the image and identity of our people. So it's an ongoing thing. It continues and will continue. I recall I did a speech many years ago at the University of Texas in Austin. I was talking about racism and the subject of African Americans and so on. And one of the law students raised her hand. She said, "You know, Mr. Skyhawk, I've never experienced racism, and I think you're somewhat of an alarmist." And I said, "Really?" I said, "You've never experienced it. Then how can you talk to about the subject?" Anyways, long story short, 2 weeks later, there was an instance where a black man was dragged in the back of a pickup truck by three white young men by his neck until he finally ended up severing his head. And that's black racism in Texas and just racism in general. But it was just amazing that people have a tendency to want to shove racism under the proverbial rug, so to speak.
And do you think, I mean, with these protesters coming out of the woodwork, I mean, is this something that's like more cause for alarm? Or do you think that, you know, most folks in Indian country are like, yeah, we know?
Well, Native people have been experiencing racism since 1492. So we know about racism and what's happened in Charlottesville is really nothing new. Racism is just below the surface. It takes something like Charlottesville or these protests to bring it to the surface. And that's the continuum of the shame of America and the fact that it continues to practice racism against other races rather than white.
Sunny Skyhawk, thanks so much for giving us a call from South Dakota, tuned in on Keeley. Always great to hear from you. And we are talking about racism today. If you want to get in on the conversation, phone lines are open. There's plenty of lines open. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Jenny Monet is with us. She's a freelance journalist, and she's Laguna Pueblo. Hey there, Jenny.
Hey.
So, you know, I just, you know, your thoughts maybe on what Sunny shared as well as the Tina Fey clip.
Yeah, I think a lot of people right now, you know, in the aftermath of Charlottesville are asking the question, did we see this coming? And after spending the amount of time that I did at Standing Rock in the Dakotas, where the recent caller was from, you know, I personally can speak to never really experiencing the amount of racism I did until I did spend that amount of time in the Dakotas. And I think that the people at Standing Rock were not surprised at all by the parallels that unraveled from Charlottesville, including the fact that the irony that what we saw was a militarized police force standing idly by as mostly white men carrying AK-47s and all kinds of other high-powered machinery and weaponry were willfully walking around and spouting off what we see as, you know, very bigoted language, and they were able to do that freely. Whereas at Standing Rock, you know, I think what the sentiment was among water protectors was that here we had a largely group of unarmed people, and as Tina Fey aptly noted, we're getting shot at by rubber bullets and doused with water cannons in sub-freezing temperatures. That's an accurate depiction of what exactly happened. And if anyone wants to look at and raise the question that did we see this coming, I think all we have to do, one has to do, is revert back to last fall and look at the kind of response that happened on the North Dakota prairie to Native Americans, who are some of the most underrepresented politically, political voices in that state and living on the most segregated margins. I personally can attest to just, you know, my own experiences of dealing with sentiments of discrimination while I was there. And I can point out very clear cases of where racism existed in a very public space, out in plain sight. Police officers harassing women in restaurants. That got circulated on Facebook. The fact that a major chain, Ace Hardware Store, deliberately put out a statement to its employees to stop selling goods to people that may be racially profiled as being water protectors, and then having to backtrack on that once that got exposed very quickly. And just there were more and more cases like this. So I don't think that it's a surprise for anybody who is, you know, racially profiled for being brown. And on that case, I'm on my way later today up to Phoenix, where major protests are expected to happen today because of Trump's arrival here for the potential pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was found guilty for his racial profiling of brown people, mostly Hispanics or people seen as immigrants here, undocumented immigrants here in Arizona. And so it'll be very interesting to see what kind of response happens on the ground. Many of the protests that are planned are anti-Trump protests.
I mean, do you really think that he's going to pardon Joe Arpaio?
There's been no direct statement yet. And I mean, as we see from this president, he likes to stir the pot and he likes to be sensational. In many ways, his presidency is his own reality show. And I mean, would he trigger that as a nation is still healing from Charlottesville? Would he antagonize that kind of a racial sentiment at a time when so many people are still trying to make sense of how to walk in this new America. And I think anything goes. And I think back to what Julian is saying is, you know, we have to be prepared for these kind of actions from this person, Donald J. Trump. I think that, you know, responding in such a way with this kind of shock and awe with every step he takes is going to be this kind of reactionary that, you know, that just becomes ineffective. And I think that as we move forward, you know, this kind of shock politics, we need to be prepared for that. We need to start thinking about how that preparedness is going to kind of create the kind of world that we want to live in and be ready. Because this, I think that when situations like this, a Sheriff Joe Arpaio, you know, what will the next one be? Whatever kind of, you know, outlandish sentiment could come out of this next presidential step, I have no idea. But I think that, you know, for us to really be guarded and have our wits about us, because right now what we're dealing with is steps that are kind of coming from the president himself. Imagine a natural disaster that happens. Imagine something that's a little bit more worldly and not really from his control, like some kind of terrorist attack or something other that's a little bit more major than Charlottesville. You know, I think that America really needs to be ready. And what you raised, that question, I think is a very, very important question, is how do we start responding to these kind of new racial tides in America, and how do we do that responsibly?
Yeah.
Not only for ourselves. Yeah, it's a very good question to ask right now.
Well, let's go to the phone lines. We've got some callers on the line waiting. Let's go to Bill in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Bill.
Hello. Hey, I haven't heard anybody mention it yet, but one of my favorite statues is the one of Don Juan de Oñate in northern New Mexico. But mainly I like it after they cut the foot off the horse, because I thought that put the monument in a little better context. That's all I have to say.
All right, Bill, thanks for giving us a call. Let's go to Dan in Belen, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Dan.
Hi. My question is, how would your guests respond to statues of the Indians in the South who owned plantations and had slaves, and maybe there's statues around about with them? And I can take the response off the air. Thank you, though.
Thanks, Dan. Let's go to James Writing in. He's the interim director of American Indian Studies at Arizona State University. James, you often put these current discussions into a historical context. Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, that question is one that is often used to discredit our positions. And it is true that some of the Indians of Southeast did develop a form of slavery that resembled that of the South, you know, and that is a negative history. But I don't hear anyone advocating creating statues to honor these individuals who were a part of that. So, you know, I think the context is different. We're talking about these statues in a national context that's a huge problem. And it goes beyond statues. You know, if we go through some of these cities on the Great Plains, you know, we see streets named after all these generals who led the campaigns against Indian peoples. We have to keep in mind that Washington and many of these other early political leaders were land speculators. They were hoping to buy land cheap and sell it so they could make money. And that meant opening up more and more Indian lands. We also have to keep in mind that we are still fighting the issue of offensive mascots in professional and amateur sports, and this is a part of this legacy. And now that the Supreme Court is taking away some of the protections that were provided by the Trademark Board to ban offensive speech, at least a trademark offensive name. So that's going to create more problems for us down the road. So to me, these are the issues that are more important rather than this one that the speaker raised, which I think is pretty much a non-issue.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Joey in Farmington, New Mexico, tuned in on KSUT. Hey there, Joey. What do you want to share?
Hi, how are you? Well, I just wanted to talk about how a long time ago when they were trying to kill the Indian and save the man, and the real type of form of slavery when everyone needs to open their eyes, when my opinion would be religion, and how they tried to kill out the Indians even to this day while killing their culture and everything. And slavery has been around since the beginning of time, and everybody needs to open their eyes and realize where the real slavery started from.
All right. Joey, thanks for giving us a call from Farmington, New Mexico, tuned in on KSUT. I wanted to bring up something that Representative Mark Wayne Mullen wrote. He published an opinion piece on Fox News, and I'll just remind you that Representative Mullen is a member of the Cherokee Nation, and he's one of only two natives in Congress. So he wrote, "When political correctness runs amok, erasing our history doesn't change it." And he says, "As a Cherokee, I can attest to the fact that Native Americans have been on the losing side of history. Our rights have been infringed upon, our treaties have been broken, our culture has been stolen." But he goes on to say, "The removal of Confederate statues in the U.S. Capitol doesn't change our history. The removal of these statues merely attempts to disguise our ugly scars by hiding these statues out of plain sight. In an imperfect world full of imperfect leaders, there are countless statues that may not live up to our American values. The statues of President Jackson, President Lincoln, both fervent oppressors of Native Americans, stand tall in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. Still, these statues tell the history of the good and the bad of our nation." And Julian, what do you think about that? So much more than just statues, but, you know, Representative Mullen is claiming that getting rid of them erases a history, both the good and the bad.
I think that it's a preposterous claim to suggest that, we are erasing history in any sort of way. I think we're trying to put history into its most appropriate context, which is for Andrew Jackson or any of these other sort of figures who, when you put them on the balance, they tilt much more towards the side of oppression than towards the side of equality, liberation, human values, essentially. And that, you know, it's totally appropriate to put these people into museums where they can be studied in their own and rightful context. I'd also like to go back to the point about the history of slavery and the participation of a not insignificant portion of indigenous societies, particularly in the southeastern United States, in that system. And I think that, you know, there's a basic point that is true there, which is that we need to also be truthful about the racism that it can exist in our own communities and has historically existed in our own communities. You know, there are remarkable stories like that of the Seminole and other indigenous nations who, aided in the Underground Railroad or fought with Maroon communities. But there is also a history of anti-Black racism in Native communities. And I think we have to just be honest about it and say that, that is part of our past, but it's not something that we are going to continue perpetuating today. And then when you look in the big picture, as James Ridingen put very, very well, that's sort of a minor narrative, right? Like that is, if you look at the big picture, that's not really the big picture of Native America.
But when you get into these discussions with people, whether it's online or in person, and these things are brought up on sort of equal playing levels, I mean, how do you explain them? How do you share your opinion in a way that doesn't get into, like, I don't know, the oppression Olympics discussion or something like that?
I think you just have to tell the story well, you have to write it well, you have to speak it well, and I think you have to tell it honestly, right? Like, I think that people can tell when you know, Paul Ryan gets up and says or tweets whatever he says about Charlottesville, or the Bushes say whatever they say about Charlottesville, that, you know, there's not an honesty there's not a truth there. And I think ultimately I believe that people are moved by what's real, by what's true, by what's told in a meaningful and powerful way to them.
Yeah, let's take another call. We have Daryl in Lacouturay, Wisconsin on WOJB. Hey there, Daryl.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I believe we need, and because this has been proven to me by people and their questions and their answers to things, so we need a revolution of thought and word, because words have put the U.S. where we are now. Now, the taxpayers pay for this, and that's because it's all about money. And money has no shame. Therefore, it bears no guilt. Consequently, it has no compassion for anything except the bottom line. What's the bottom line? It's the profits from the bombs, the bullets, and the bandages of war, either domestic or foreign. And that's the cowboy way, the American way. Now, why do I say the cowboy way? Because what would this country be without John Wayne, Dale Evans, Roy Rogers? There's cowgirls out there, too. And you go all the way down the line to Dirty Harry and Rambo. And what did these cowboys all have in common? Two things, only two things, attitude and guns. And they always use both.
Daryl, thanks so much for giving us a call from Wisconsin. Tuned in on WOJV. Doctor writing in, you know, Daryl brings up something that often when we go through these conversations and we talk about oppression, we talk about this, we talk about that, and then inevitably it comes to capitalism, and capitalism is the reason for all of this. And if we just solved the problem of capitalism, somehow that would resolve racism and our racial issues. What do you think about that?
I would hope that that would happen. But what we need to do is find ways to promote justice, equality, and do away with these notions of inferiority and superiority that are used to deny human and civil rights to mostly brown-skinned peoples, and also, in some instances, white impoverished people as well. So, capitalism is a problem. It needs to be made more humane if we want to retain it. But I think part of the problem that underlying this issue is that we're under the leadership of a president that is facing severe challenges to his presidency. And I think his impeachment is probably just impending for him being incompetent, irrational, and some even say insane. So we have to keep in mind that, you know, how is this coming into play in this stirring up the racial divide in this country?
Jenny, I was thinking a little bit about, you know, what the president says when, like, if you listen to that whole press conference, you can also hear him combatively, you know, denouncing the press, saying fake news, you didn't do your job, mm-hmm. things like that. As a journalist, you know, do you take much with what he's saying, or, you know, take that seriously, this attack on the press?
I think it's a very interesting time to be a journalist today, and one that should not be taken lightly with that kind of handling of what I consider to be one of the most noblest professions. I think today what a journalist's ultimate role is to carry impartiality to the utmost degree and to write with integrity and void of any kind of emotion, because I think that that is where anyone looking to discredit any kind of message, particularly when it pertains to, you know, intense conversations around race and discrimination and inclusion, really needs to be handled quite responsibly. And I think that that's really the climate that we're in today. I also feel like in this space, we also need to be really, really aware of the kind of narratives that are circulating out there. For instance, in this conversation about monuments, you had two news outlets who were suggesting to blow up Mount Rushmore, and not any one of them considered even contacting any Lakota Sioux individual to see what if that might even be a solution to defacing Mount Rushmore and returning the Black Hills to them.
Jenny, was it, sorry to interrupt you, just curious, was it like one of those headlines like, Are we suggesting blowing up Mount Rushmore? Was it like one of those where they...
No, it was the Daily Caller saying, let's blow up Mount Rushmore, and then it was Vice News latching onto it.
Okay.
And they were both outsider narratives, and no one chose to consider even calling a Native American, or for that matter, a Lakota Sioux individual to even discuss the matter. And it was outsider splaining, in which they completely got the history wrong in the first place. So back to what even the last caller was talking about, you know, using our voices and using them with integrity. That kind of bottom-up voice, when used with integrity, can be quite powerful. And if Standing Rock proved anything, I think that's what it was.
Jenny, we're getting close to the end of the hour, but I wanted to know, you know, what are you going to be looking for tonight in Phoenix? What are you going to be covering?
Well, one of the angles I'll be talking about, what I'm hoping to grab while I'm there, is this broader narrative and how it relates to Indigenous peoples and some of the Latinos in the area. You know, Arizona is a melting pot of a lot of mixed indigeneity, and they often get racialized in ways that go beyond, but never really dip into these stories of where their places are in the state, and where their feelings are, particularly when we're talking about a potential pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. So my sensibility is to look at not only the Indigenous narrative today, but also to take a look at their call for promoting peace, particularly even among counter-protesters, because even what we saw in Charlottesville, there was some violence on the side of counter-protesters, and the Indigenous way, in the spirit of Standing Rock, is nonviolence, peaceful, nonviolent, direct action.
Well, we'll definitely be looking at that as well. Thank you so much to our guests today, Dr. James Ridingen, Julian Brave, Noise Cat, and Jenny Monet. We're back tomorrow with a show about sex trafficking in Native America. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Tara Gatewood is our host. Marino Spencer engineered our show today. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support by the Association on American Indian Affairs Indigenous International Repatriation Conference, Journey Home, Empowering Indigenous Communities in International Repatriation. September 25th and 26th at the Isleta Resort in Albuquerque, the focus will be on learning, sharing, and discussing cultural and human rights issues of returning ancestors and cultural items to their rightful places. Information and registration at Indian-Affairs.org.
Keshe, yam is to medical cause alite na tu. Look ya olo ikan a yamaz na to medicate na to cheap an ati na na tu. 1-800-318-2596 and pen an akin. That is medicaid.gov in Tonawa Nua. Look at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Don't know what Ben and Ito look at now. Ella, qua.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael David. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.